This is PM's special budget coverage. Welcome to listeners everywhere, including on News Radio tonight. I'm Linda Mottram. Full analysis coming up of a budget that the Treasurer says is partly banking on a COVID vaccine next year. This is not where the Morrison government saw itself at the last budget, that's for sure. Conservative orthodoxies about debt and deficit have been ditched for now because the furniture has to be saved, and that means jobs before all else, as the Treasurer has been outlining. Let's dive into the details. So to the key elements of this most unusual budget, our political reporter Melissa Clark has been in the budget lockup today for PM. G'day, Mel. A budget certainly like nothing we've ever seen before. Just how big is the recovery task?
Well, according to Treasury, this is the greatest challenge to the economy since the Great Depression, so since the 1930s. And look, to give us a sense of that scale, before COVID-19, the government was forecasting to post a surplus of $6 billion. That has obviously not happened. Instead, we now have deficits as far as the eye can see. In fact, over the next 4 years, there'll be $500 billion in deficits. So the government's got a new strategy. It's no longer focusing on bringing the budget back into black. Instead, it's focusing on economic recovery and creating jobs as a priority.
And, you know, quite a dire picture. I mean, $500 billion, it's just not a sort of set of words you would have imagined a year ago. So what's the government proposing to do to rescue the economy?
Well, look, it's really a mixture of measures here, and there are five key ones amongst it. And first of all is the new announcement of a job maker hiring credit. This is virtually, essentially a new wage subsidy scheme for any business that employs a new worker aged between 16 and 35, so targeting young workers who have been unemployed recently or getting certain welfare payments. Businesses who hire them will get a weekly cash payment of $100 or $200. Now, this will cost in total $4 billion, but it's very much targeted at getting young people into work. The other big initiative that we're seeing, a second big initiative, is temporary tax incentives for businesses to invest. So basically, businesses, virtually all businesses in Australia, any business with a turnover of less than $5 billion, can deduct the full cost of depreciable assets up to any value immediately. So that's a huge measure. It's going to cost $26 billion in tax relief over 4 years. And there's going to be extra loss carryback provisions to help businesses as well.
Now, among the other initiatives, is one of them infrastructure? The government had flagged that there'd be more for that.
Yeah, that's certainly a key part of this process. Infrastructure spending is going to increase by $10 billion over the next 10 years. And that's on top of previous announcements of infrastructure that the government had focused on prior to COVID-19. The government says this will support around 40,000 jobs directly and indirectly. Look, the other two initiatives here are ones that have previously been announced, the extension of JobKeeper that was announced as Melbourne struggled with its second wave, and the income tax cuts that are being brought forward that the government had put out a bit of detail about just before today's budget. Bringing forward those tax cuts will mean more than 11 million Australians will get extra cash in their pocket from their salaries. Treasurer Josh Frydenberg says the income tax cuts are key to driving household spending.
These tax cuts are backdated to the 1st of July. These tax cuts will put more money into people's pockets, and that money will be spent across the economy, and that money will help create jobs. It's Treasury's estimate that some 50,000 jobs will be created as a result of those tax cuts.
The Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, there. Mel, given how many people are out of work and how many businesses are struggling right now, how quickly can the government turn this plan into reality?
Well, the government wants this to be into action ASAP, but there's no guarantee that everyone who gets more in their pay packet because of income tax cuts will actually spend it rather than save it. They certainly can't spend it if they don't get the money. Now, the government says the tax office can begin adjusting pay-as-you-go tax within a week or two, but before that, it needs to be legislated. And Josh Frydenberg says the Australian Tax Office needs other parties in the parliament to indicate they'll back this plan.
They can do so when they have a sense that this measure and our other tax measures, which are going to form part of one bill, are being supported across the parliament. So tomorrow I will introduce a bill to the parliament. We want this measure to be implemented as fast as possible.
Josh Frydenberg there. So, Mel, has the government come up with an estimate of the impact of all these initiatives?
Now, the government's saying all of these measures will mean that GDP is about 4.5% higher than it would be if COVID-19 had ravaged the economy and no action was taken. And it says that unemployment would be 5% lower because of these measures than what it would be without them. So it's basically saying unemployment would be as high as 13% if not for these measures. But it does acknowledge that there is a lot of uncertainty about just how this will play out and just what COVID will look like in the future as well.
Uncertainty, that's the key here. Thanks very much, Mel. Mel Clark will join us a little bit later with some more details on some specific areas. Let's bring in our business reporter, David Taylor, now, though. G'day, Dave.
G'day, Linda.
What is the damage here?
The damage is big, Linda. A deficit of, as we've heard, of $213 billion. Now, look, there's plenty of money going out. This is the whole point of a deficit. Money going out, money coming in. 90% of the COVID support spending is going to be complete by the end of next financial year. So the government's initial response to the COVID-19 pandemic provided roughly $300 billion in overall support. And in this budget, the government is providing an additional $98 billion in response and recovery support. That includes the $74 billion under the JobMaker plan. So 2020-21 budget brings the government's overall coronavirus support to $507 billion. And Linda, payments then, if you include the entire gamut, is $670 billion. Now, most Australians are still in work, so revenue hasn't exactly dropped off off a cliff completely, but total revenue for this financial year is expected to be $472 billion. But over a million unemployed has obviously damaged that. So the budget's telling us that it's lost $55.2 billion in tax revenue from that. That's compared to the MyEFO report published late last year. And naturally as well, the other part of the income side of the balance sheet is company tax receipts. The government's making it clear it's very uncertain.
So that leaves us with the biggest shortfall in the history of the budget. How much is the government borrowing to support the economy and jobs?
Well, this is where the figures get very big. Net debt, $703 billion this financial year. Linda, gets as high as $900 billion in 2022-23. That could take it to $966 billion in 2023-24. Linda, that's close to $1 trillion, or 44% of GDP, close to half. Finance Minister Matthias Cormann says the numbers add up and it will ultimately, he insists, put younger Australians into a better economic position.
The reason why we've taken on this level of debt is because we care about the future opportunities for young people across Australia. The message is, and I've said this at the July Economic and Fiscal Outlook, there was no alternative. If we had not done what we did, the level of disruption would have seriously undermine the opportunity for years and years to come.
Matthias Cormann there. So, Dave, the government's also laid bare its forecast for the economy. How is it expected to fare over the next few years?
Look, not surprisingly, this financial year we're looking at -1.5%. So that's a recession. Move forward to 21-22 when we're looking at 4.75%, so a big economic rush following the government stimulus. That's the line. Then we go back in 2024, we go back down to 3%. Still, Linda, that's very good economic growth considering what we have been having.
Okay, and just quickly, unemployment?
Unemployment set to peak at 8% in the December quarter, 7.25% over this financial year. Again, it's forecast to drop to 6.5% in the June quarter of 2022. So the government's forecasts are still optimistic.
And uncertainty is the key thing here, isn't it?
Massively so.
Yeah, especially around the vaccine. Thanks very much, David Taylor, our business reporter. So the federal opposition has been critical of some of the government's economic responses to the pandemic. Jim Chalmers is the Shadow Treasurer. Jim Chalmers, good evening and welcome.
Thanks for having me on the show, Linda.
Given all the uncertainty, do you welcome the government spending big like this across such a broad range of areas with jobs at the centre?
Well, clearly the circumstances warrant a lot of government support. So that's been obvious for some time. Our issue is what we actually have to show for this $1 trillion in debt. They've racked up $1 trillion in debt, but they're still expecting unemployment to be too high for too long. There's no real vision or plan for the future, and it still leaves too many people behind. Just take one example, Linda. You think about the hiring subsidy, the wage subsidy that they've announced tonight. 928,000 people on unemployment benefits are not eligible for the hiring subsidy. And that just goes to the missed opportunity, I think, of racking up $1 trillion in debt and still leaving all of those people behind.
But still, you know, on the government's numbers, GDP is going to be 4%, 4.5% higher than it would have been without these measures. Unemployment will be 5% lower than it would have been. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty here. This is a better result than we would have got otherwise.
Look, there is uncertainty, and the government hasn't been exactly bang on when it comes to predicting what's going to happen in the economy. But let's talk about unemployment. I mean, they have racked up $1 trillion, and still, at the end of the forward estimates, unemployment is still higher than what it was before COVID-19. And so the point that we are making and our concern with the budget, there are some elements that we will support, but our concern is, having racked up $1 trillion, unemployment's still too high for too long. It doesn't say enough about the future or build, you know, a lasting legacy from all of this debt. It doesn't undo all the damage of the last 7 years. And they've managed to spend $1 trillion still without doing anything about childcare or anything meaningful about public housing or anything meaningful about cleaner and cheaper energy. The list goes on and on. And so it is a missed opportunity. We do acknowledge that the COVID crisis is having an impact on the economy and the budget. There's a responsibility for the government to respond. But we need to get maximum bang for buck for all of these hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars in new borrowings. We need to make sure that that's effective.
Yeah, you're saying there are those who've missed out, but surely there has to be a limit to the eye-watering debt, especially given that, you know, next year the pandemic might come back and bite us all over again.
Of course, Linda, but it comes down to how you design these programs. You know, for example, obviously it makes sense to have some kind of hiring incentive for workers. But what they've done with the cutoff is meant that if you're over 35 years old, there's nothing in terms of JobKeeper as that trails away. JobSeeker for the time being is going back to $40 a day. And for 928,000 people on that unemployment benefit, they can't access these hiring subsidies. So there is an issue here with priorities. There is an issue here with the balance of what they've announced. Some of it we will support, but there's an issue there when you can rack up so much debt and not get enough bang for buck.
Now, Josh Frydenberg says he will introduce legislation tomorrow for the accelerated income tax and the temporary business investment incentives, so tomorrow, and that Parliament needs to indicate it will support it straight away so the ATO can get to work on it. Will Labor support it with that haste?
Oh, look, I think that's a typical kind of political approach. It's looking for a political outcome rather than an economic outcome. We've already indicated that we will be supporting the changes to the income tax cuts timeframe. We support tax relief for people on low and middle incomes. We've said that repeatedly. We've called for some of those tax cuts to be brought forward so the ATO can take their guidance from that. When it comes to some of the other measures, we're inclined to support the business tax measures as well, but we've only seen them since 3:30 this afternoon, so it's a bit rich for him to be making those sorts of demands. We're inclined to support them, but one measure alone costs $27 billion in the forward estimates, and so I think it's only responsible for us to say that we're inclined to support it. We see what they're trying to achieve, but we will work through the detail and make sure that spending that much money in this initiative is responsible and that we'll get that maximum bang for buck that we're looking for.
The Coalition's relying heavily on assisting the private sector to reboot the economy. Is that the right approach?
Well, obviously the private sector is the key job-generating, job-creating, wealth-creating part of our economy. Nobody contests that. There's an important role for the public sector too, but overwhelmingly the workforce in Australia is a private sector workforce. A lot of people have lost their job during the course of this crisis. The private sector economy was actually quite weak coming into this crisis, and that left us vulnerable. So there's a lot of work to do there. We've had a business investment problem for some time, even before this year. We have had an issue with business having the confidence to invest because there's been energy policy uncertainty in other areas too. So we need to address that. We need to get the private sector purring again because that's how we create jobs.
Okay. Jim Chalmers, thanks very much for your time this evening.
Thanks again, Linda.
Jim Chalmers is the Shadow Treasurer with his response there to the Treasurer's budget this evening. You're listening to PM. This is a budget special for you here on ABC Radio. Shortly, academic and former politician Helen Hodgson on what the budget delivers for Australian women who have been disproportionately affected by the pandemic's economic slump. We will also get the views from trade unions, from small business, and if you stay with us for the next little while, we'll also get some final thoughts on what the government is offering in aged care. There is $1.6 billion in funding for home care for older Australians in the budget. And obviously aged care has been a focus because of the Royal Commission in the first place, and then the additional tragedies that we've seen in aged care facilities as a result of the pandemic. So we'll get some reflections on that as well. And our economist, independent economist Angela Jackson, will join us a little bit later too. We'll also have some voices from people who might be affected by this budget, from renters and others who might be looking at this budget for something to help them out in a difficult time. This is PM. Stay with us on ABC Radio. This is PM's special budget coverage for 2020. I'm Linda Mottram. Thank you for joining us. Just to recap, the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, has handed down the federal budget for this year in conditions that nobody could ever imagine. The nation, of course, and the globe, ravaged by the pandemic, and that is defining absolutely everything that we're looking at in this budget. The greatest economic challenge since the Great Depression is how the government is characterising it. COVID-19 has turned a prospective budget surplus into a sea of red ink. The budget deficit this financial year will be $214 billion. Over the next 4 years, there'll be $250 billion. Net debt will peak in a couple of years at 43.8% of GDP, a lot better than a lot of comparative countries, it's got to be said. That's $966 billion. Unemployment, the really key one here, is set to peak at the end of the year at 8% by the government's forecasts. And the government is taking a new approach, no longer demanding fiscal discipline and chasing budget surpluses. Instead, this is a budget focused on economic recovery and creating jobs, looking at the private sector to reboot the economy. There's also cash payments to employers who will take on young and unemployed workers, accelerated income tax cuts delivering more than $17 billion into workers' pockets, which are designed to get people spending, and there is $10 billion in additional infrastructure spending, as well massive tax incentives for businesses to make new purchases and carry over their losses. Here is a bit of the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, from this evening's speech. It's all about jobs, he says.
Tonight's budget is our economic recovery plan to rebuild the Australian economy and secure Australia's future. It's all about jobs. It's all about helping those who are out of work get into work and those who are in a job stay in a job.
The Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, there. Well, one of the big features of the budget is the bringing forward of tax cuts, and that's left business owners feeling hopeful that it will give them a much-needed shot in the arm. Fazila Farhad runs a large family hotel at Cabramatta in Sydney's southwest, and told Gavin Coote that she's been eager to see a plan for the struggling accommodation sector.
Since the COVID situation, accommodation we kept open, but of course our gaming and our restaurant got closed, so we were very much affected by the closure. We had to put a lot of staff on hold and of course did not let them go because we weren't JobKeeper. I think personal income tax is going to be important because if you actually got staff that is with you, that helps them in their dollar spending. Even if you cut down some of their hours, they're getting more dollar coming into their pockets is going to help them. So it should be across the board. And I think the higher brackets should have a better reduction so that even if their hours are reduced, they still get something back into their pockets. Of course, corporate tax doesn't even come into the picture because if you're making money, you're paying it. So I wouldn't really leverage for a reduction unless I start making a lot of money, which is going to be taking time. There needs to be proactivity on the aviation industry as well. We'd like to see what are the plans of the government to bring the aviation, international aviation industry back, because we right now don't hear anything. And that is something that we need to hear from the government as businesses and tourism operators.
Fazila Farhad is the managing director of a Southwest Sydney hotel. Well, with over 1 million people currently unemployed across Australia, job creation has dominated the government's roadmap to recovery. So what does this budget mean for workers and jobs? Well, Michelle O'Neill is president of the Australian Council of Trade Unions. Our reporter David Taylor spoke to her a short time ago.
Well, this budget fails to deliver for working people. It fails in two key ways. The government is projecting in its own forecast that unemployment is going to rise to 8% and then stay as high as 6.5% by 2022. So there is not enough job support there, not enough saving existing jobs and creating new jobs. The second thing is that even when the economy starts to improve with a forecast projection of 10% growth in the economy, zero amount of that is shared with working people because there is zero wage growth projected.
There may be zero wage growth projected, but certainly the wage price index is forecast to rev up as the economy revs up. Do you accept that?
Well, what we're concerned about is also the unknown here, because if the government listens to some in the business lobby, then we're concerned that coming IR changes may cut workers' wages and conditions. And what working people need is money in their pocket to be able to spend. That's what will make the difference for consumer confidence.
Now, if we look at breaking it right down in terms of the outlook for unemployment, for instance, it's forecast to peak at around 8% in the December quarter and then come down gradually over the next few years. That's positive for workers, isn't it?
The other thing about this budget is that it fails to do what's needed to support people to save existing jobs and to create new secure jobs. So, for example, the wage subsidy that's been announced for young people, there's no requirement that those jobs continue. There's no requirement that they be secure jobs. They can be casual, they can be part-time. And we're also worried that money that's going to business is not guaranteed to get into the hands of working people. We've already seen through the JobKeeper program rorts where money goes to CEOs' bonuses and to shareholders' dividends. There needs to be conditions on taxpayers' money that guarantees that it gets to working people.
Under the JobMaker plan, $74 billion of government revenue is being allocated towards that. In addition to that, you've got tax breaks being brought forward. And there's, in fact, with the low and middle income tax offset, you've got essentially a bit of a double whammy for workers. They're going to get, by this time next year, quite a bit of extra cash in their pockets. If you add all that up, will that generate the sort of economic growth and job creation that will lead to what the government is forecasting?
Well, the first thing to say about the tax cuts is that if you haven't got a job, you don't get any benefit from them. And also, even for people who are on low incomes and many workers don't have enough hours of work, they also get zero benefit from tax cuts. In fact, the tax cuts are going to mean that if you're on the minimum wage, you get $2.11 a week, whereas if you're a high-wage worker, you're going to get nearly $50 a week. And we know that the tax cuts give men twice the benefit as women in as far as those improvements go. The other thing about it is that tax cuts ultimately leave us all worse off, because it means that there will be not the money needed to spend on the public services that we've seen so much this year are critically important for our community. So where's the money that we know now needs to be spent on aged care? Why doesn't this budget deliver mandated staff ratios and increases in funding to aged care that are accountable? And also, where is the commitment here to make sure that we're creating jobs that are going to get to women as well as men, get to workers in the public sector as well as the private sector, workers in country towns as well as in cities, and make sure that we're looking after young people and older workers?
Michelle O'Neill, the President of the Australian Council of Trade Unions, speaking with David Taylor. Well, lockdowns and travel restrictions in the fight to contain COVID-19 have meant the flow of customers for many businesses has just dried up, particularly in Victoria with its second wave. Of course, the economic spiral downwards has left a good proportion of business owners barely surviving or knocked out altogether. Wage subsidies have been a lifeline so far. So what's in the budget for small businesses? Peter Strong is the CEO of the Council of Small Businesses, Council of Small Business Australia. Peter, hello and welcome.
Thank you very much.
The JobMaker hiring credit here, it's going to see businesses get $100 or $200 a week to take on someone who's under 35 and unemployed. Is that a good incentive? Will businesses take that up, do you think?
Look, it's not a big incentive. It's good money and businesses will view it that way. But if you're paying $800 a week and $100, you've got to make a decision whether that means it's worthwhile to employ someone, and businesses will do that. They'll make that decision, but it's not a big subsidy. In the past, we've seen subsidies that might be 50% of a wage for the first the 3 or 4 months as people become productive. The thing that's missing as well, if I can say, is the ability to deliver these very good, I mean, across the board, this has been fantastic, but to deliver them at the local level to small businesses and to the people, the unemployed people, who need it. So we're talking about a good employment service, not one that just provides employment services to unemployed, but brings the business community together with the training organisations to make sure that the skills these people are getting is what business needs. And that's one of the things we've been looking for a long time. We called it place-based support for the community so that all the money the government's spending gets spent better.
And that's not here?
No, it's not.
So what's the implication of that? I mean, what is happening in businesses or what is going wrong as businesses do try to put people into positions or train them as a result of not having that sort of formula you're describing there?
Well, then you're going to have people without the skills that businesses need. So you go to a community and, you know, we're going through a hard time, you might find a lot of people are unemployed for the first time ever. So they're not used to this. So we need to get to them on day one. The employment services we have at the moment are designed to get to people when they're long-term unemployed. Now, we don't want 300 or 600,000 people to become long-term unemployed before we do anything for them. And they'll use the current system. They'll use the SEEK and all those sorts of things. But we're talking about getting to them and saying, okay, you're not used to being unemployed. This is what you need to do. Here's the training courses that are there. Make sure the training courses meet the need of the business community. So we're saying you do skills audits in local communities. You go to Geelong or you go to Horsham or whatever, and you do a skills audit and say, well, this is what we need. This is what we have. How do we change that? How do we use it to our benefit as a small economy?
So a bit of work to do there. Now, part of the business investment incentives announced by the government tonight is allowing immediate depreciation of the entire cost of new asset purchases. Given there's already accelerated depreciation for small purchases, is this measure going to help small businesses or is it really aimed at big business?
No. The measure will help small businesses for a couple of reasons. One, the instant asset write-off is still there. But secondly, big businesses who are spending will be spending with small. That's what we know. We know that the connection is quite strong. Now, we've worked really hard on insolvency laws and unfair contract terms and a whole range of things to make sure that relationship works well. We have a good relationship with the Business Council of Australia to work on that. But when big business thrives, so does small. And the other side of the coin is when small business is going well, so is big and medium businesses. They often get missed out here. And in the end, that's all about the workers. And I can say, obviously, we didn't talk about workplace relations in the budget, but that's an area that has to be dealt with if we're going to really confront unemployment as well. That's one of the pillars of employment, is to make it simple.
OK, Peter Strong, thanks very much for joining us tonight. Peter is the CEO of the Council of Small Business Australia. Now, earlier we spoke to our independent economist, Angela Jackson. She set the scene for us. Uncertainty, I think, was the first word out of your mouth then, Angela. how do you view the numbers overall, first of all, the predictions the government has in here about where this budget's taking us?
Look, optimistic, I think, would be the word you'd use. It's certainly got an optimistic view of the economy over the next sort of 6 to 18 months, far more optimistic than I think a lot of economists have. And if this comes to fruition, then yes, this economic downturn will be a lot shorter and a lot less severe than many of us had feared.
Do you think these measures to support more, getting more unemployed people into jobs, using, you know, smaller infrastructure, shovel-ready projects in council areas to get more jobs, do you think that's going to work to really create more jobs?
Look, it's fairly small fry in the overall scheme of things. I think this budget really is about backing business, certainly ahead of backing women, can I say, Linda, which hasn't occurred in this budget. The predominant focus is really on getting businesses to spend and businesses to invest over the next 6 to 18 months. Now, if that occurs, then we'll see this recovery, but it's quite a big bounce back, especially sort of on looking at historical levels in terms of business investment, and that you're expecting businesses to invest because of these incentives, even though the economic outlook may remain pretty uncertain. Mm. And so if that doesn't come to fruition, then the economic growth forecasts won't come to fruition either.
And the Shadow Treasurer Jim Chalmers argued to us just a short time ago that the government's forgetting those who are unemployed who are over 35.
Look, that's true, and you know, there is going to be questions certainly about that. I think a focus on the under 35s is warranted. We know that the long-term impacts for those workers are greater. You know, if you don't lose your job early in your career, there are lifelong consequences. So I'm not as concerned about that focus. For me, really, the lack of focus on female jobs and on getting women into work is really what's missing in this budget. But I'm, to be honest, a bit shocked that there wasn't something in there, and that it's predominantly, again, focused on male jobs and male industries.
There is a second women's economic security statement to come, $240 million worth of programs, cadetships,
over five years,
not enough.
It's not much. It isn't much. And I mean, just by comparison, and I think this is important, you know, to spell out pretty clearly, the backing business stuff, it's around $32 billion, and they're saying that's going to derive about $10 billion of economic growth. They could have invested tonight $5 billion in childcare. That would have delivered $11 billion worth of growth. The returns on these investments are great, and I think they've missed a real opportunity tonight.
Those are very stark figures.
Angela,
thank you very much indeed for joining us this evening.
And
Angela Jackson, independent economist there. Quite stark figures on the women's investment, or lack of it. You're listening to PM's Budget Special on the radio, on the ABC Listen app and via the podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. Shortly, Leanne Wells from the Consumers Health Forum. Well, just as jobs became all the more scarce, many of the day-to-day expenses continue to rise, and many families are under financial stress and they've been looking for some reprieve in the budget. Sydney professional Ahmed Shadi is juggling three jobs to cover the rent and rising road tolls indeed. And as the sole breadwinner, he told our reporter Gavin Coote he's keen for concessions on his tax and bills.
I'm an Egyptian migrant. I've been living in Australia for the last 5 years. All of which was in southwestern Sydney. Recently, I've been working in the city for the last probably 1.5 years almost. Personally, I'm disabled, so I'm driving here. Initially, it was the cost of like petrol, depreciation, etc., and then the tolls kept getting added.
And this is one of three jobs. You're working three jobs at the moment. When you finish up at this one, what does the rest of the evening look like for you when you get back on the road?
So I work in a firm in the city, okay, as a migration agent, and my own business as well. And I do teach continuous professional development to fellow migration practitioners. I teach law. That's part-time. I do have a family. I'm the sole income earner. I've got three children. As a middle-tier income earner, I feel that there is no reprieve, you know. I mean, all costs keep increasing. I'm barely making ends meet because expenses keep increasing.
What are some of the budgetary measures that the government could provide to just help make it a little bit easier to help you get by?
Well, first and foremost, I think middle-tier income earners are the ones who are copying it the hardest. All we're asking is not to add to these problems.
That's Sydney migration agent Ahmed Shadi. Well, our reporter David Taylor is back with us, Dave, because I wanted to ask you about ordinary wage earners and the promise of personal income tax cuts. How much better are they going to be off?
Well, significantly better, hopefully. And this is stuff going right into the hip pocket. The government will bring forward stage two of the personal income tax plan from 2022 financial year to this financial year. So the stage involves increasing the low income tax offset from $445 to $700. Now, the low and middle income tax offset. You can get lost with the different definitions. That also, Linda, remains in place, which is going to be around $1,080 for individuals. The big picture, Linda, the majority of the benefit for 2020-21, which is this financial year, will go to those on incomes below $90,000, and that's capturing an estimated 11.6 million Australians.
And are they going to have to wait until July or August next year to get the extra cash?
Look, they will for the low and middle income tax offset, but for the low income tax offset, which has been brought forward, that could change how much tax that your employer takes out. Now, the ATO is going to do a bit of backflips and cartwheels with this one, but essentially once the ATO is convinced that Parley agrees with what's going to happen, both sides of Parliament, it's going to get the nuts and bolts of this in action. So week to week, your boss will change how much tax he takes out or she takes out.
Okay, David Taylor, thank you very much. Now, this pandemic has exposed weaknesses in our health system, in aged care, mental health, but also in health supply chains, and the capacity for a national health response has been exposed and sometimes worked and sometimes hasn't. Well, Leanne Wells is with us. She's the CEO of Consumers Health Forum. Leanne, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Linda.
What's in this budget for health?
Look, there's a really mixed selection of things in the budget for health. I mean, obviously, there's a big investment of money, $11.5 billion over the forward estimates, but there's still only down payments in some areas of really high need. Telehealth is really important. That's been a major disruptor and a major innovation, and that's been so important for everyone to be able to continue to access healthcare safely as well as for our clinicians. But they're still only temporary arrangements, so while we've still got them until March, it still leaves the question open that what are things going to look like there for the next, beyond March. Really welcome measures in mental health, increases to subsidised services through the Better Access Program to psychologists. But there's a word of caution there from us. There are still big gap payments for those services, and that does still put mental health care, which is so vital at this time, out of the reach of the very people who probably need them most. It's been really good to see a strong rural health strategy, because I think, that's been where access to care and the deficits in workforce and the need for particular models suited to rural communities have been exposed in the pandemic. And of course, aged care. How can we not comment on this budget without commenting on the serious failings in aged care? So there's been, some welcome, again, down payments in home care packages. That's where people want to get most of their aged care, but an extra 23,000 packages falls really short of what's needed.
So how would you characterise this approach? Is it just a sort of a sprinkling of a little bit everywhere? Is that what the government has done rather than diving into, full-scale reform?
Look, I think I think the minister's words were particularly with regard to telehealth, that it's the beginning of the revolution. So I think we have seen big disruptions in the way healthcare is delivered in the pandemic. Telehealth, we've seen unprecedented cooperation between public and private hospitals. So there are clearly things in this budget that the government's continuing to invest in that we want to see retained. But there's clearly also future directions in primary care and the way we deliver primary care, and mental health and how we can boost funding there, particularly around peer support models of care and things like that. So, look, it's a really good budget for health. I mean, it clearly features ongoing substantial dollars for the ongoing COVID response. I think the fact that we've got 10-year primary health care plans and 10-year national preventative health plans in development due to be submitted to the minister early next year raises a lot of hope and certainly a lot of aspiration in our mind for what the next budget could bring. I know that we're talking about this budget now, but the next budget's not that far away.
It's not, and a lot of uncertainty in between. Leanne Wells, thank you very much. Leanne is the CEO of Consumers Health Forum. Look, let's go back to our political reporter, Mel Clark, to reflect, I think, on how different this budget looks compared to just over a year ago. Mel, really unprecedented. How would you describe the way the government's approaching these times? Because there's a bit of ditching of the orthodoxies, isn't there?
Well, there is, but there's also, in some ways, a very classically Liberal Party approach to this recovery. You know, in the new economic and fiscal strategy that they have set out, you know, in the past it was to focus on the return to surplus. That's been abandoned. The new approach is to drive sustainable private sector-led growth and job creation. And that's really important here. Private sector-led is really important. There's not a nation-building approach or direct employment schemes, massive investment in Commonwealth assets like we might have seen in previous times, like the Great Depression, the last time we had an economic crisis of this size. Instead, this is about giving businesses tax breaks and cash incentives to employ people and giving salary earners more spending money. Finance Minister Matthias Cormann really steered this budget. It's his seventh and his final budget as he's about to retire. And he's made it clear that this plan relies on businesses and household demand to reboot the economy.
And as we set out to grow out of this COVID recession, private sector businesses across Australia will be the key to the jobs recovery and the jobs growth our economy needs and which our budget needs. That's why in this budget, most of the fiscal support is aimed at giving businesses the confidence to invest in their future growth and success.
Matthias Cormann, the Finance Minister, Mel Clark, our reporter there. Well, let's just talk about the fact that this budget doesn't have a lot to say about women specifically. It doesn't have a sort of a gender lens over the entire suite of measures. Helen Hodgson joins me to discuss that. Helen, do you get what is your response to how the government has addressed the question of women being hit so hard in this pandemic?
Well, I think that it's interesting because they're focusing, as Mel said, on the private employment sector. But what they've ignored in doing that is the places where most women work and where most women's jobs are. So we would have liked to have seen much more focus on investment in the care economy through there's a little bit of money for more aged care packages, but through aged care, through childcare, because that has a double effect. First of all, it stimulates the economy as women are in more secure employment, but it also increases participation rates. And we can't see a lot in there to stimulate the service economy, the care economy.
Yes, we were speaking to independent economist Angela Jackson earlier, and she said there's a huge multiplier effect on spending in areas where women are most affected. Now, we're going to see the Women's Minister, Maurice Payne, deliver a Women's Economic Security Statement. Is that where we're going to see a bit more of this, do you think?
Well, it's interesting because there is a very short economic statement hidden in the budget papers. So there's a short statement there, and if that's all that Minister Payne is going to be offering, it doesn't really add much to what was delivered in or offered in 2018. So it includes one thing that we support is that there is some additional support for women for paid parental leave where they wouldn't have met the 10-month test because they were out of work because of COVID. Now, that's something that we brought to the minister's attention some months ago, so I'm glad to see that that's been picked up in the budget. And then there's some money for specific STEM initiatives. But then the other programs are around leadership and entrepreneurship, which comes back to this concept that the way out of the economy is through business and through private effort rather than public spending, which is what Mel was saying earlier.
There's a lot more to unpack there, but I'm sure we'll get to it another time. No, that's fine. Helen Hodgson from Curtin University, thank you so much for your time tonight. Look, just a quick final couple of thoughts as we wrap up from David Taylor, our business reporter, Melissa Clark as well. Mel, first of all to you, what has stood out about the government's approach to these unexpected times we find ourselves in?
Look, the really interesting thing is that there's no radical moves here. The government is really taking tried and tested approaches to economic recovery. We're really seeing an expansion of existing programs. So, you know, we've had accelerated tax depreciation. That's long been a tool for business stimulus. We saw it even during the GFC. Now we're getting a larger version. Likewise, this job maker hiring credit is pretty similar to existing incentives for businesses to take on long-term unemployed people. And infrastructure spending, of course, is a very conventional approach to fiscal stimulus. So I think if we see a conservative fiscal approach like this in concert with pretty conservative conservative monetary policy approach. You know, the RBA isn't moving towards negative interest rates and money printing, quantitative easing, that sort of thing. What we really have is a national government taking advantage of long-running economic strength to take a very tried and tested policy approach to economic recovery.
Okay, and David Taylor, your final thoughts?
Well, Linda, here's where I'm a bit confused. The government is supporting the economy right now, and they're hoping, it's hoping, that businesses and consumers will take the baton from it. Now, there's a big problem here because, as we've been reporting on PM now for months, what business and consumers want is, or what they need to have is confidence. Businesses need to know that when they throw money at something, it'll bear fruit. Consumers need to know that when they spend money, their job will remain and hopefully in the future they might even get a pay rise. That's what they want. That's what will encourage them to spend. But the big unknown that hasn't changed, of course, is the coronavirus vaccine. The government expects that it will be distributed widely among Australians by the end of next year, but that is a big unknown. We simply don't know when that is going to happen. We can only speculate at this point. So all of the government forecasts and this big push to get jobs created that will then stimulate the economy, that then will repair the budget, is all based on a coronavirus vaccine being implemented, distributed. And we need to get businesses and consumers feeling confident about that. So it's a circular argument, but we still haven't solved that fundamental problem. And that's how this economic crisis has come to be in the first place.
Yes, indeed. And of course, that vaccine may or may not turn up, but also the path that the pandemic itself takes.
That's it.
Is a big unknown.
We simply don't know what's going to happen.
And continuing huge global effects. Look, thank you very much, David Taylor, our business reporter, Melissa Clark, our political reporter, and to all our guests tonight. Thank you very much. A lot to unpack in any budget, but this one most especially. It is, well, dare I say it, historic. Look, thank you for joining us for PM's budget special. I'm Linda Mottram. Join me at 6:30 every weeknight, 4 p.m, or subscribe on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy the rest of your evening. Speak again soon.